This is Srinivas Rao, the host of the Vistage podcast series. Despite our intentions, why do we so often fail to act in our own best interest? Why do we promise to skip the chocolate cake only to find ourselves drooling our way into temptation when dessert tray rolls around? What are the forces that influence our behavior? Today, I'm speaking with Don Ariely, whose research is dedicated to answering these questions. In addition to his work as a professor at the Fuqua School of Business, the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience, and the School of Medicine at Duke University, Dan is also the New York Times bestselling author of the books Predictably Irrational and The Upside of Irrationality. Thanks for taking the time to join us today, Dan.
Oh, my pleasure.
So one of the very first questions I have for you is related to the experiments you conducted in your book around incentives and performance. Ironically, the people who had the highest potential for earnings in the experiments performed at their worst. What are the implications of this for small business owners?
Yeah, so first of all, let me kind of give you a slightly background on the question that we were looking at. So this basically emerged after the issues in Wall Street. And the question was, under what conditions do big bonuses lead to better performance? Under what conditions might they backfire? And what we've done was we created conditions in which we gave people really a lot of money. So the stakes were very high. And what we found was that when the tasks were involving things like cognitive skills and memory and concentration and so on, the bigger bonuses actually backfired. But when we use it for very simple tasks, big bonuses were actually better off. And the way to think about it is that when you try to do harder, when you try to work harder, you try to work better, can you? Right? And I think that with physical tasks, it's easy to imagine how you can do that. So, for example, if I tell you jump and I pay you more per jump, you would be able to, you know, flex your muscle faster and jump more and do it for more hours. But what if I tell you to be more creative or more thoughtful or have a better memory? Can in the same way, can you actually focus on your memory and make it better, and focus on your creativity and do it better? In fact, the answer is no, because in those kind of cases where you try harder, you actually distract yourself and you actually do worse off. Mm-hmm. So for business owners, I think what they need to do is they need to understand how well do their employees perform without any external conditions, and do they want them to start thinking about money, or do they want them to start thinking about only about the task? Mm-hmm. If you're a physician, for example, and you're doing a delicate brain surgery, I don't want you to think about money. I want you to focus wholeheartedly. But if you're doing you're gardening and you're doing something that is not occupying your whole brain, focusing a little bit about money and thinking about it is not that bad. So mm-hmm. I think we need to really be more careful about what tasks are we trying to motivate and to what extent is money going to drive people to higher performance and in what extent thinking about money will distract people.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's interesting that you brought up the creativity component, because one of the things that I have experienced and I've noticed with a number of entrepreneurs is when that sort of pressure is removed, they tend to do some of their best work because they feel free, I think. I think it's just a sense of freedom that comes, and that results in much more innovative and productive work in my experience.
Yeah, there's a very nice book by John Lehrer called Imagine, in which he discusses when people are more creative or not. And one of the conclusions there is that when people are either tired or slightly drunk, this actually helps creativity, because creativity is not a process that you can actually control. You can't sit in the office and say, okay, now be creative. Come on, be more creative. It doesn't work like that. In fact, it's the opposite. It's this idea of getting completely immersed in a task, not thinking about anything else, and just kind of going with what's called flow, which is a state of mind. So that's incredibly important to think about how we create those environments and how the incentives and the worries might actually detract from it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that actually makes a perfect transition to my next question. You know, one thing that we're experiencing in society as a whole, and there's this just sort of undertone going on, is that people are really wanting to do more meaningful work than ever before, and wanting to have meaning to the work that they do. How can business owners meet that need for their employees and for themselves?
Yeah, so this is kind of a fantastic news about the human being, right? Mostly my research is about the dark side of human being, about how people are irrational, and that's kind of not that good. In this case, the search for meaning is actually a wonderful part of human irrationality, right? In the economic model, we would only care about how much money we make, but the reality is that people are motivated by lots of stuff, something that gamers have discovered in the last few years, right? That people can be motivated by a sense of progress and a sense of competition and a sense of achievement and a sense of, you know, social reputation and the way that they think about themselves. And meaning is one of those things. Meaning is something that gives you an extra sense of motivation. Now, here's the question. Imagine that you are running a business, and you can treat your employees like cogs in a machine and say, okay, just perform this task, and don't worry about what it's for and who is going to benefit and what's down the line. Just spend all your time doing that. Or you can say, let me take 5% of your time, and let me use that time to tell you about why we're doing these products and what we think will happen to the company in 5 years from now. And who are the people that we think we're helping? And let me tell you a story about one of our customers that was really helped by us. The second approach might seem like it's a waste of time because you're taking 5% of these people's time and you're doing something inefficient in it. But the question, of course, is whether these inefficient time, the 5 minutes, would actually get them to be more productive in the other parts of their time. And I think one example for this is Google. And, you know, it's hard to get good numbers from Google in terms of what's happening inside. But here's a company that took 20% of people's time and said, with this 20%, do whatever you want. And first of all, what you see is that people don't do nothing with their time. Instead, what they do is they do all kinds of great products for the company, and they join with other people and other teams and so on. So even this time off is not really time off. But I am willing to bet, and I have no data, but I'm willing to bet that it also makes people more efficient in the other 80% of their time, because now they think differently about the company, they think differently about the customers, they're more connected to the mission of the company in general, and that helps them be more connected. So as a business owner, you have to ask yourself, how much are the people working for you buy into what you're doing? Mm-hmm. How much are they doing it like peons on the board that are just kind of doing what they're told? And how much are they invested so that they put their heart and soul into it? And heart and soul turns out to be, this is not nice to say, but they're cheap to buy, right? People don't need a lot to find some meaning of their workplace, and the returns are quite dramatic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you make some fabulous points. I particularly appreciated the fact that you said giving them that 20% will make the other 80% more productive. And that seems very counterintuitive, you would think. But in mm-hmm. my experience, what I found is that when people are happy, they do better work. That's all it boils yep. down to.
But it's not just happy, right? Happy is one state, right? Happy is kind of like you sit on the sofa and you watch Seinfeld, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you're kind of happy. The real question is engagement. In economics, we think about two types of contracts. We think about what's called complete contracts, when I can write down exactly what you have to do, and you know what you have to do, and I know what you have to do, and I can measure it, and I can pay you accordingly. And then we think about incomplete contracts. An incomplete contract is stuff that I can't write out exactly what you will do. I depend on your interpretation and your goodwill. And most tasks are incomplete contracts, if you think about it, right? There's almost... You know, if somebody maybe cut the lawn in your house, you could basically create a specific contract. But outside of that, it's really hard to create a complete contract. There's all kinds of things that you depend on the goodwill on the people on the other side. And now ask yourself, what would get those people to actually go the extra step? Mm-hmm. And when something calls for it, think about somebody on customer service line. I mean, that's a very simple job in many ways, but they have tremendous latitude, and they can have tremendous importance for the company. If they care about the company, they might go an extra step and get a real customer for life. And if they're a little upset, they might destroy a customer who might actually go and tell all their friends not to use that company anymore. So all of a sudden, you say it's not just happiness. It's really kind of commitment and willingness to go the extra step that are incredibly important.
Mm-hmm. So I want to ask you another question. One of the other concepts that you talked about in The Upside of Irrationality is this notion of why we overvalue what we make. As somebody who's a blogger and content creator, a podcaster, and an entrepreneur, it's something I experienced firsthand. And I think as a society, again, we're moving in a direction where businesses today have this ability to customize their solutions, and consumers have an ability to customize what they buy like never before. So how can business owners incorporate this into their own efforts, especially, say, if they're not selling a consumer product like a shoe, kind of like the example you mentioned when you talked about Converse?
Yeah. So first of all, we need to understand why is tailoring important. And there's basically two ways in which tailoring is important. One is that if people are able to have a voice in what they get, they might get something that they like more. So, for example, if some people like blue and some people like red, and you let people build their own shoes, the people who like blue will have more blue shoes, and the people who like red will have more red shoes, and that would kind of solve the what's called the endogeneity problem, that everybody would select the product they like better. But the other thing that what we find out in what we call the IKEA effect is that when people start building something on their own, they start caring more about that. And this is about attachment more than about preferences. It's about the fact that once you start building something, and that's why we use the IKEA effect, once you start investing some of your own internal energy into something, all of a sudden that thing becomes more valuable. And you can think about it as an employee, or you can think about it as a customer. But the idea is that your sweat and blood, the moment it's put into something, make that thing more important. And by the way, we all realize it about kids, right? When you look at kids, do you have kids?
I don't, actually.
You know, but when you will have kids, or if you know, if you talk to other people who have kids, you ask people, you say to them, how much would you sell me your kids for? You know, all the memory and stuff like that. They say no amount of money in the world. You know, when they're teenagers, of course, the answer changes. But mostly they say, I wouldn't sell it. And then you say, imagine a world in which you don't have kids, and you go to a park and you meet these kids and you play with them, and they're very much like your kids. And after a few hours of playing with them, you're saying goodbye. But just before you go, their parents said, hey, by the way, if you're interested, they're for sale. How much would you pay for them? And most people realize at that moment that it's not that much. Why? Because the reality is that our love of our kids is largely a function of our investment in them, and it's largely a function of the fact that they're our kids. But not only do we overvalue them, we don't seem to notice or to realize the extent to which we overvalue them. And instead, we think we're valuing them objectively. And the same thing happens with all kinds of other investments. And of course, this is the main curse for startups, right? People do a startup, they have an idea, they fall in love with their idea, they think everybody should love their idea. Because they invest so much time and effort into it, they think it's fantastic, and they're actually unable to see the world in an objective way and to see the fact that other people might not appreciate it to the same degree. Mm-hmm. So we all have to learn about this, and we can either think about how to not fall prey for it or how to take advantage of it. Mm-hmm.
So that actually makes a really beautiful transition to the final question that I want to ask you, and that is that concept of the not invented here bias, which I think is very relevant to what you just said about startups. Can you expand on that and talk about how people can make sure they don't become victims of it?
Yeah, so the not invented here kind of problem is a problem of falling in love with what you like and basically creating a barrier between what you have created and what other people have created. And the moment ownership colors your view, it's very hard to take ideas. And this can happen within a company, right? It can happen within a company where somebody had an initial idea and somebody else come with an improvement or a contradictory idea, and you basically are discounting their ideas because of that. And then, of course, it happens from other companies. You have your own software component you're going to develop, and somebody else is doing the same thing, and you're saying, yes, but we are so much better, and it's so much better to take ours. And for the inside company issue, I think the main remedy is to basically try to share the ownership. Sharing ownership is actually a very good thing, because the moment that more people feel that they are the owners and creators of a product, more people are committed to it. And all of a sudden, it's not the case that it's me versus you. It's basically kind of permeates the whole group. In terms of thinking about how we are going to deal with things that are invented outside of the company compared to inside of the company, I think that what we need is something like blind tasting for wine. You know, when you taste wine and you know what the label is and you know what the price is, you can't help but be influenced by those. But when you do blind tasting, all of a sudden you're not influenced by that. And I think to the degree we can, we should try and take the ideas and present them to people in a way that is basically stripping away the irrelevant information and the irrelevant origin of where they came from, and try to discuss the ideas purely on their merits. And hopefully this could help. I'm not sure it would solve everything, but it would help.
Well, Dan, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today and share some of your insights with the Vistage listeners. This has been Srinivas Rao, the host of the Vistage series. And until next time, good luck with your business.